Good day, wherever you may be, and welcome to Observations for Our Time. We have Scott and Kirk here today, and we're going to begin just with a bit of a diatribe. I was reading one of my news feeds this morning, and the headline was that Donald Trump was scary when it comes to his comments about Islam and Muslims. And I can only assume that this numbskull writing the headline in the article was addressing his most recent statement where he said, I think Islam hates America. Now, it is true that a religion isn't isn't an individual. So while a religion can inspire people to hate, and Islam certainly does that, and Islam is responsible for the hate, and the fact that most Muslims do hate America, and that Islam is an extraordinarily hateful and violent and despicable religion, and the fact is that 99% of all terrorist acts worldwide are perpetrated by Muslims. All that being true, it is rather astonishing that we have entered a period of time where if you wish to work in the media, newspaper, radio, television, if you wish to engage in politics, if you want to manage a large business, if you want to work in any academic institution, you are required to be inaccurate. It is not possible to be politically correct and accurate at the same time. Those are mutually exclusive concepts. We have reached a period where our media, where our politicians, and where our professors and teachers have collectively decided that it is vastly more important to lie on behalf of socialist secular humanism than it is to tell the truth. And that the only way to be politically correct is to be absolutely, unequivocally, undeniably inaccurate. Now, how would you, even if you were to write a scenario that would render people incapable of exercising good judgment at a time where information is pervasive? For example, if anybody wants to understand the religion of Islam, if they will invest 50 hours of their time, they can read the 1,000 pages of evidence presented at Prophet of Doom, prophetofdoom.net. Everything you could ever want to know about Islam. It uses the religion's 5 oldest and most credible sources to present the religion in Muhammad's own words. It's irrefutable. The information is available. And any one of the people who would write an article that said that Donald Trump is scary when it comes to Islam, I mean, they could read any newspaper and see that 99% of all terrorist acts are perpetrated by Muslims. Or they could read the Quran. Or they could read the Quran in the context of Muhammad's life with the coordinating hadith in Prophet of Doom and understand the religion and know that what Donald Trump is saying about Islam is correct, mm-hmm. which is why it's politically incorrect. Now, it's the reason that we have reached this point is that the elite in academia, in politics, and in the media, and in even large corporations, they want to control. Control is their opiate. Once you reach a certain amount of money, money does not buy satisfaction. And so the only thing that is more valuable than money is control. And the best way to control people and manipulate them in an environment where information is readily available is to render them incapable of thinking. That's what political correctness does. It makes being judgmental, discerning, discriminating a crime. And so we do
factor.
Yeah, we do things like, for example, about 1% of men and about 2% of women are homosexual. Therefore, homosexuality is abnormal. It's the very definition of abnormal. When it's 100-1 or 50-1, that is abnormal.
Yeah, not the norm.
It is not the norm. It's not healthy, and it's certainly not productive. Now, I don't care if somebody's a homosexual. Don't care. Matters not to me what consenting adults do in the privacy of their own homes and apartments. Don't care. But when people want to go out in the public marketplace and promote a lie because that lie makes them feel better, I've got a problem with that. Because now they're promoting as good and normal something that is clearly abnormal. That's wrong. If, for example, we have all of the people that are out protesting Black Lives Matter, and they're pretending like the justice in America, the justice system, is unfairly treating blacks. It's actually unfairly treating everyone. There is no justice in America. Mm-hmm. Police are overly violent. They're way overly armed. And there's really no difference anymore between the U.S. military, federal agents, and your local police. They mistreat everyone. And the Justice Department, with its crime labs with the FBI, deliberately and knowingly fabricated evidence for years. And they ignore the Constitution with the NSA and the collection of information without due process. And so we are in a period of time where the Justice Department is working against everyone. But for blacks to complain that it is racist without the associated context of when there is violence between blacks and whites, 8 times out of 10, the perpetrator is black and the victim is white. But if you say that, you're not being politically correct. If you pretend that the problem is whites against blacks, as opposed to blacks against white, you are publicly crucified. And yet if you say the other perception, then you're wrong. So to be politically correct, you have to be incorrect. How in the world is anyone going to render a reasonable, just, or moral conclusion in that kind of an environment? Kirk, I have been saying for a long time, and Scott, that it is impossible to use evidence and reason with a religious person.
Right.
Neither evidence nor reason resonate with a person of faith. That is the single most caustic nature of religion. And I've been saying it for a long time, and as we read here recently, Yahweh concurs.
Mm-hmm.
He has specifically said that religion renders a person incapable of thinking. But you know, the problem is that while Christianity is clearly the largest and most debilitating religion, and therefore the most deadly religion of all time, and today Islam is the second most popular religion, the third most popular religion on the planet is socialist secular humanism, atheism, and various forms of political agnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to tell you that those who are socialist secular humanists, who would claim that they are driven by reason, are as unreasonable as people of faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, socialism is communism, is Nazism, is all that. That's a religion.
Right. You know, can you imagine that in Europe, where this indoctrination, or not indoctrination, this flood of Muslims coming into Europe by the millions, it's debilitating. It's economically debilitating because they don't work. And it goes right back to Muhammad. Muhammad didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And Muhammad did not create a religion that condones work, condones barbarism, stealing, terrorism. You know, the Islamic economy during Muhammad's time was organized crime. Still is. And so this debilitating nature of the Islamic migration into Europe, if you explain it, you know, that's a real problem because the Quran and Hadith encourage Muslims to rape, encourage them to kill, encourage them to be in opposition to any form of government other than devotion to Allah and Sharia law and the Quran. And their moral code is the antithesis of what was originally established as a result of Judeo-Christianity. And yet if you explain that, and explain there's a reason that they went out of the Middle East, because in the countries that Islam is the dominant force, there is no hope. There's no opportunity. There's no freedom.
Not a whole lot of food.
Yeah, the Muslims are the least educated, least inventive, least productive people on earth. And they create living hellholes for one another. And they do not embrace the values of multiculturalism. And Saudi Arabia, if you're a Shiite, you have no rights. There are no Christians.
No.
If you are a Christian in Syria, you're as good as dead. Your children are hauled away and raped. If you're a Sunni Muslim in Iran, or in what is still Iraq, you have no rights. If you're a Kurd, which is a racial minority of some 40 billion people, not 40 billion people, I'm sorry. Of some 40 million people, I think is the number. I'm sorry, 40 million people. If you are a Kurd, a racial minority in eastern Turkey, northern Iraq, and northwestern Iran, just because of your race, your ethnicity, you have no rights. And yet, if you expose any of that, talk about it honestly and openly, if you actually explain what the Quran and Hadith say, what Muhammad did, the fact that he was a terrorist and a pedophile and a rapist and a mass murderer and a slave trader and a kidnapper, and that those were his primary proclivities, then you're called an Islamophobe. Now, you tell me, how could you be afraid of Islam if you're willing to expose Islam? Since Muslims respond to such exposure by threatening to kill, yeah, those who do, you would be the antithesis of an Islamophobe. But yet in the media, you can say Islamophobe of a critic of Islam, and you're considered enlightened when your statement is stupid.
Now, you also left out the part where Islam is totally racist towards blacks.
Well, of course.
Africans, they...
Oh, yeah. Look what happened in the Sudan.
How do you embrace that and put that in your little group of...
And the Sudan is a mess by any standard.
Sure.
But in the Sudan, the Arab Muslim government in Khartoum, in a genocidal rage, wiped out 2.5 million Africans. Now, the Africans that they killed, because the Arabs have no respect in Islam for Africans, were mostly Christians and animists. And when the Muslims, the Arab Muslims, killed African animists and Christians, 2.5 million of them, no one seemed to care.
Mm-hmm.
When they started killing African Muslims in the Darfur region of the Sudan, then Hollywood had a conniption fit.
Mm-hmm.
Big rallies around that, but they only killed about 100,000 African Muslims, the Arab Muslims did. And so, yes, Islam is racist. You know, the elitist are criticizing Donald Trump as being a sexist, as being misogynist, as being in opposition to women. Now, I've never heard anything that he said other than, you know, his criticisms of the Fox
reporter.
Reporter, yeah, whatever her name is.
Or whatever she is.
Well, his criticism that she was trying to make a name for herself as opposed to moderating a debate so we could learn about the candidates, his criticism was correct. She was way out of line. However, he criticized her by saying she must have been on her menstrual cycle.
Yeah, it's,
Now, that's pretty stupid. But there is no indication that the man is sexist. And yet those who are against him because he said, you know, we have a real problem. There's a real serious problem with Islam. And that those who will then advocate on behalf of the religion are complete hypocrites because women have absolutely no rights. They're trash in the religion. They're forced to wear tents over their bodies. They have no freedoms. They have no rights. They have no opportunity. They're owned by men.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the left will work to promote the religion while denouncing someone who is critical of it as a sexist. And if you were to compare the sexism of Donald Trump to the sexism of Islam, you know, it's like comparing, you know, a 75,000-watt transformer and transmitter to a walkie-talkie. Kind of in the same world. We've absolutely lost our ability to be reasonable, to think. Now, the reason I brought that up in this program is that there's no other way to know Yahweh. None. He can't be known through the heart in an emotional sense. He can't be known through faith, through belief. He can only be known through evidence and reason. That's it. You can see him in his words. You can observe him in his testimony. But if you aren't willing to examine the evidence and then rationally consider it, you have 0% chance of knowing who he is, of knowing him relationally, of understanding what he's offering, or knowing how to capitalize on it. He specifically communicated to us in a way that if you are willing to examine the evidence and consider it rationally, that he proves beyond any doubt that he authored the testimony that is found in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He did that through prophecy, through precise, historic, and future predictions and presentations. His history, past, present, and future, is so profoundly accurate that he proves that he authored it, that he is liberated in time, that he has witnessed our future and has recorded it in our past, and our past beyond recording written records, right back to the Big Bang that he said that he used to create the universe, even that testimony is precisely accurate. And so he proves that he authored this testimony, and therefore he proves that he exists, and he introduces himself to us in only one place, and you can only see him, come to know him, understand what he's offering, and capitalize upon it through evidence and reason. If you aren't willing to do that, he cannot be known. And if you are religious, you're incapable of doing that. If you're politically correct, you have been dumbed down so that you can no longer think. You're incapable of being discriminating and discerning, of exercising good judgment. So 99% of people, Kirk and Scott, are incapable of processing what we share in this program.
I've given a lot of thought to this week, and one of the things that I've observed in people who actually start the path, read a lot of the material, and really seem like they're getting it, and then they walk away, and I'm trying to figure out what caused them to all of a sudden not get it, and it could just be as simple as we've become so lazy.
Mm-hmm.
In our relationships, you know, it takes a lot of effort. It doesn't mean it's not fun, but it takes some
right.
effort. I mean,
right.
to sit down and read and study the Torah.
Yeah, and I have not encountered anyone that I can think of other than one, I think it's one woman amongst the many thousands who have begun this journey, who have read significant portions of Yada Yah, Intro to God, Questioning Paul, that have read significant portions of those books. I have only met one person who came to realize that what was being said, read enough to realize this is absolutely true. And irrefutable, in fact, that turned away. Now, her reason for turning away was very personal. In the case of this particular woman, her daughter died. and her daughter died as a evangelical Christian. And the notion that she would, that her daughter's soul no longer exists,
and they
which is a fact, and that they would never be together.
Yeah.
Never be together. I mean, she could not be together with her daughter even if she were an evangelical Christian, because there is no together for Christians.
Together.
There is, now, if her daughter was a leader in Christianity, whether she was, you know, had reached the point where she was a pastor and was misleading people and taking people away from God based upon earning a living doing it, then there'd be a possibility that she could do the same thing and they could spend their eternity in Sheol, and what Christians know as hell. That's not a very good option. But her daughter's soul no longer exists, and she knows it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a mother trying to reconcile that in her mind that oh my, I'll never see her again.
Yeah.
Is beyond, you know, and that, by the way, is the number one. I think there are three reasons that Christianity prevails.
Mm-hmm.
One is that to not be a Christian in a Christian country has until very recently been extremely uncomfortable, very difficult to do. You know, if you were to denounce Christianity and in Europe, for example, or even in the Americas, prior to about 100 years ago, they'd kill you.
Pretty much. You'd be ostracized, right?
We'd certainly be ostracized, but in most places they would have killed you. They'd torture you before they kill you, too. And so that's one of the reasons. One of the other reasons is that fathers poison their children. They very few children grow up any different than their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of people are just willing to accept anything, and as you say, they're apathetic.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you've got a whole world out there now that has been dumbed down or is absolutely allergic to evidence and reason that you just can't reach.
Are they frightened? I mean, do they get it, and they're just too frightened to fight against City Hall? I mean, is that what
yeah.
it is?
Well, you know, a part of it is the great appeal of Christianity is you're going to see your loved ones again. You're going to walk through any cemetery, all the gravestones says, until we meet again.
Hmm.
You know, and that's, you know, I won't go to a Christian funeral because it's just full of all this. Well, you know, God wanted them.
Stuff.
God wanted them, and we'll get to all be together. Or, you know, the Christian media darling, whether it be in any form of entertainment or athletics, will say, my dad or my mom was looking down on me. Yeah, yeah. And it's and so it makes them feel good, but it's an absolute lie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an absolute lie. And so, but that's one of the reasons that Christianity succeeds. That's one of the reasons. The other reason is not to be a Christian is almost impossible. In most cultures, it's now possible in America. But there's a lot of places in America where you say, you know, like you go to Texas and say, you know, I am not a Christian. I'm in opposition to the religion of Christianity. You know, you're going to get beaten up if you make that as a public pronouncement. They'll beat you up. Yeah, just like in Texas, you know, I'm not going to stand for the Star Spangled Banner because I'm not patriotic. You know, I'm in our home in Ohio right now, and the guy that's running for Congress shows pictures of him as a Marine with his MR-16, his assault rifle, and he says, you know, vote for me because I have the patriotism of a warrior. God, I want to puke.
So does Shaul.
Yeah, so did Shaul, King Shaul. Worked out really well for him.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of reasons that people cling to the religion. They fit in, they belong, it makes them feel good. But so long as you're religious, you have a 0% possibility of knowing God. He's not going to allow anybody who is religious to enter his home. He's not going to have a conversation with somebody who is religious. And it's the first requirement for participating in the covenant. And there is no salvation, there is no entry into God's home, there is no relationship with God apart from the covenant. And the first condition of the covenant is to walk away from Babylon. And Babylon is symbolic of religion. You know, I ran across something late last night. I was... I know that, and for those who are listening to this who have already received the fourth chapter of Observations for Our Time, there's a mention late in the chapter that we're, when it talks about leprosy, that we're going to turn and consider at the end of the chapter Numbers 5. And you, then you get to the end of the chapter, at the psalm, the chapter's on Psalm 91, and there's no presentation of Numbers 5. That's because I wanted to turn to Proverbs 7, which I'm going to mention here in a moment, and then turn back around and write the translation for Numbers 5. But I came last night, I was finished my translations of Proverbs 7, and I turned to Proverbs 7 because Roy had sent it to me based upon the translation we're doing right now of Proverbs 6. And we'll continue with it in just a moment for this program. And it is based entirely on the seduction of the whore. It doesn't call the whore of Babylon. It just describes the means that the whore uses to seduce. And it goes on quite some detail about the seductive nature of the whore. At the very end, the last line, I think it's the 27th verse of Proverbs 7.
Mm-hmm.
We're finally given a name that is associated with the deadly plague of this whore. I'll give you one guess whose name is there in the last statement.
Sure, it's Shaul or lowly little.
Shaul.
Yeah.
Right there.
So,
bigger than life. Shaul.
It's in Hebrew. It's got to be Shaul.
Right. And I have said, and I want to reemphasize this point, that the whore of Babylon, and that's the first condition of the covenant, you've got to walk away from Babylon. The whore of Babylon is Christianity. Pure and simple. It's Pauline Christianity. And it's Pauline Christianity for a lot of reasons. One is that every aspect of Pauline Christianity mirrors the Babylonian religion. The Lord is God. Easter is the most sacred holiday. That's named after Ishtar, the Babylonian queen of heaven and mother of God. You know, 1.3 or 4 billion Christians, more than half of the total Christian population in the world is Roman Catholic. And then you have another 400 million Orthodox Christians where they literally have shrines and temples and statues to the queen of heaven and the mother of God, the Madonna and Child. That is the center focus of the Babylonian religion, where that God is known as the Lord. And they celebrate Christmas and Easter, both Babylonian holidays. They have a trinity. That's their litmus test, Babylonian entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Dying and resurrecting God, Babylonian. Virtually every aspect of Christianity is based on the Babylonian religion. And, of course, Pauline doctrine, Paul's letters, are based on the very meaning of Babel, which means to corrupt, to pervert.
Confuse, yeah.
Yeah, to confuse. And so the whore of Babylon is Pauline Christianity, and you don't need to take my word for it. Read Proverbs 7. It's the last name on the list.
Well, you know, the section we're going over right now, 6, in all the little translations I've got here, pages and pages mm-hmm. of it, I've got little stories where it talks about the plague of death.
Introduces to the whore, too.
That's been the great gestalt, I guess, of going through these things. I couldn't believe how many times it keeps popping up.
Right.
I mean, you have to go more than one lexicon, but it don't take much. It
doesn't take much. Yeah, God had more to say about Christianity than any other religion. And that includes the religion of Judaism. Because the religion of Judaism did not exist at the times that any of the Torah prophets or Psalms were written.